You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education Issue Review podcast for the edition covering the 15th to the 21st of May 2014. My name's Chris Parr. This week I'm joined by reporters Holly Els and David Matthews, books editor Karen Shook and news editor Simon Baker. The University and College Union is to pursue around 30 universities for millions of pounds of pay it claims was unlawfully deducted from staff who took part in walkouts earlier this year. That's the splash, and we'll have more on that in a second. The amount of money pledged to UK universities by donors last year fell by more than 10%. More on that in a second. We hope you've been enjoying our regular books podcasts. The latest with Dante scholar Prue Shaw is online now. Host Karen Shook is on hand today to talk us through this week's book section. And our cover feature this week looks at universities' role in training the public sector workforce, from nurses to the police. And we'll hear a little more on that later too. But first, Simon, there's a row brewing between the UCU and a number of universities where staff took part in two-hour walkouts earlier this year.
We say it's brewing. I suppose this goes to the heart, really, of the kind of dispute there was over the pay rise, the 1% pay rise offer, which sparked all the strikes, really.
The row is now brewed.
I just think, this has been resolved now on the face of it, because there was a decision, basically, a couple of weeks ago. All the members of the UCU were asked if they'd accept a 2% pay rise for next year. And on that basis, they've decided to stop the marking boycott that was planned and stop the dispute over the 1% pay rise that was offered this year. But what kind of happened at around the time that the UCU called a number of two-hour strikes was that a number of universities said, well, we're going to take away pay for a whole day for those staff that go out for 2 hours. And at the time, the UCU said, well, that's unlawful. You can't do that. We'll take you to court. The employers said, well, yeah, we can. It's called partial performance. Contract, allow us to do this, and employment law allows us to do this. But it was never really tested in the courts. They never really brought any action. There may be a question here about if the UCU had kind of brought any action before the dispute was resolved. Would the dispute have carried on? What would have happened then? Did everyone kind of decide to accept the 2% offer, thinking we're going to keep losing a whole day's pay? This was never really tested. Mm. But what's happening now is the UCU is going back to these institutions saying, look, it's been resolved now. Really, do the right thing. Give that money back. Otherwise, we are going to go to court. Some universities have said, changed their position, and they've said, I think the one that we highlight, Sheffield Hallam, and said that, as a gesture of sort of goodwill, we'll give this money back, because the dispute's been resolved. A lot of others are standing firm at the moment. So whether it will go to court or not, we'll see. We've got a legal expert who said that if it does go to court, it's possible a judge may rule against the UCU, because in this legal expert's opinion, what they were doing, did have a basis in law. But that doesn't mean that's what will happen. So we'll see now if kind of it will end up in court and whether this issue will be resolved. But the reason I say it goes to the heart of the dispute is because a lot of people were losing a day's pay, really, for doing sort of going out on strike for 2 hours. Exactly. And if they probably thought, well, if that's going to continue to happen, I don't really know if I want to continue with this action. So it's quite important, really. Mm. Let's go to the heart of how things sort of ended up.
There's a great bit of detail in the story. Yeah. Where there's claims that the Sheffield Hallam deducted around £250,000 from its from staff pay, and that's not actually in dispute.
No, that was from the one-day strike.
That was from the one-day strike. Yeah. But there's been claims, although they have been rejected by the universities, it's the same amount of money that the university spent on sponsoring the Tour de France, which will come through Sheffield this summer.
Yeah, around 270,000. Although we should say that Sheffield Hallam denies that and said that that data is commercially sensitive, so we don't know how much it actually was.
And they also said that it will be repaid many times over in the opportunities that the tour will bring to enhance teaching and recruitment.
I think there are a lot of cyclists who may consider, you know, leaving the peloton and perhaps signing up for an undergraduate degree.
Once they see those logos.
It's worth considering.
Well, having been a cycling fan and seeing the sort of pain they go through all the time trying to cycle about 150 miles, I can say they should go to university. It's a lot easier.
There we go. Moving swiftly on. David, mixed news for universities as regards fundraising from donors, in a survey that you cover on Page Six this week.
Yeah, that's right. So today sees the release of the sort of annual Ross Case survey of how universities are doing in raising money from donors. It's a bit of a mixed bag, to be honest. I mean, so the good news is, for 2012-13, which is when the survey covers, the actual amount of cash that universities got in from donations went up by a quarter, and it's now almost two-thirds of $1 billion, which is pretty impressive stuff. The bad news is the actual amount pledged in that year went down by more than 10%. I mean, the reason the discrepancy between those two figures is donors might pledge a certain amount in one year, but then pay it out over several years hence. Now, I spoke to people in the sort of who work in university fundraising, and they say, well, in this kind of area, there are inevitably sort of ebbs and flows, because, you know, one year you might get an absolutely whopping great donation of, you know, 50 million to a university, and that can quite seriously skew the results. But I mean, it is a little worrying for universities, because they're trying to increase the amount they get from donations. Firstly, because government support is being withdrawn, and, you know, it's free money if you can get it. I mean, you look at the amount that US universities raise, and they've built huge endowments often with substantial aid from philanthropists. The other slightly bad piece of news in here is that the number of fundraising staff in universities, I mean, that's only gone up by about 4% or so in that year. Now, to hit a target of £2 billion a year that the sector wants to get to by 2022, they're saying they're going to double or triple the number of fundraising staff over the next 8 years. So that's far from being on track in that respect, and that's a bit of a warning sign. I mean, also interesting, the report, I mean, it's just the incredible disparity in success of universities in getting money. And Oxbridge raised about half of all new pledges, and it's this incredible stat. Oxbridge had about 100 times the amount of money pledged to it in that year than all 15 institutions in the million plus group that were included in the survey. It's absolutely staggering inequality. I mean, you can say great for Oxbridge, or you can say, well, this is extraordinary inequality.
I mean, Mary's in the Russell Group as well, though, doesn't it? I'm just reading here in your story. Yeah. In contrast, the amount of money pledged to the research-intensive Russell Group institutions, excluding Oxbridge, also dropped by nearly a third in 2012-2013. Compared to million plus, but also within the Russell Group.
Exactly. Stark. I mean, the thing is, you might say, well, you know, it'll always be dominated by Oxbridge, and I very seriously doubt anyone else will ever overtake them. But on the other hand, you can say, what Oxbridge are raising is pretty, you know, it's pretty standard for major US state universities. So if Oxbridge are only at that kind of that point in relative to the American context, you can maybe get some of the other universities up to what Oxbridge are now in 10, 15 years. Who knows?
I mean, I've been seeing the fundraising kind of story over sort of several years, and I don't want to be a pessimist or a cynic. Well, I'm a journalist, of course I'm a cynic. But I just can't, you know, this kind of donation sort of giving to universities is embedded in US university culture. It's just not, it just doesn't happen in this country. And I'm really quite cynical about it ever happening, really, apart from, you know, the universities got major brand kind of clout like Oxbridge. But I mean, when you look at this other, I thought this stat was amazing in your story as well. Five institutions with the sort of weakest fundraising operations spend an average of nearly £17 on fundraising for every pound they bring in.
We had to check that several times to make sure it was true, but that is that is
Oxbridge
accurate.
Spends just 7p.
It's incredible. So
because
some,
obviously they get huge donations and everyone knows them, they don't have to put any effort in. So
well,
you can see
they've
why.
Got huge fundraising teams, Oxbridge, with lots of experience.
Okay, right.
But you're,
sorry,
if you're Oxbridge, you're going to... If the
not
other,
they don't put any effort in, but
and one of the problems is you've got few, you don't have many fundraisers, and so the pool is quite small. So basically, you know, if you're a budding fundraiser and Oxbridge says, "Come work for us," you're probably going to leap at that chance, which means everyone else is left with people with who are relatively inexperienced. So that's where the workforce problem comes in as well.
I mean, it may be that, you know, with fees, we're seeing it might change in 20 years because with fees, we might create more of a culture that's like the US where people sort of see more of a private contribution linked to universities. I just think there's more of a culture in this country that, in historically, you know, your tax funding goes towards funding universities and that, you know, that people feel that that's what should be done almost and that, you know, that. Should they be giving back to universities?
Yeah.
But
in terms of not, culture, it takes decades and decades and decades to change, doesn't it? So it's not a short-term solution.
Well, from balancing the books to our books section this week, Karen, what's in store for readers this week?
We've got a bumper book section this week, a few extra pages. Fred Ingalls considers Terry Eagleton's book Culture and the Death of God. Flora Samuel, Professor of Architecture at Sheffield, talks about the Lawn Road Flats, the Isochon building in Hampstead, which was a nest of spies. Apparently there seems to be some correlation between modernist architecture and skullduggery.
Is that the collective noun?
That's right, the nest of spies. And Tara Brabazon looks at Dana Boyd's latest book. Dana Boyd is a big American name in new media studies and cultural studies. She's a fellow at Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society. Her argument in It's Complicated, The Social Lives of Network Teens, Tara points out that, like a lot of new media scholars, they fall prey to the idea that Twitter, the internet, the Facebook, the email is all some kind of new and bizarre thing that only teenagers understand and their behavior is completely different. Tara points out that not only has the internet been around for 45 years and the World Wide Web for 25, but actual grown-up adults use social media as well. And the problems that young people experience in terms of bullying and so on online is part of a larger context of what happens in the rest of their lives. So there's a lot of stuff in these books. Tara says that it's kind of like the old people don't understand and the young people are all right. And she knows wherever she speaks. Sandra Leighton Gray at the Institute of Education reviews a fantastic book called Thanks for the Feedback, The Science and Art of Receiving Feedback Well. This is done by two academics at the Harvard Negotiation Project. And on the face of it, this looks like a book we should all secretly sit and read. How to listen to your boss say, I think what you need to do is. Sandra, bless her, though, says, you know, this is really useful. I'm sure I'll be going to meetings and university staff development departments will be putting this at the back of the room for you to flip through in the coffee break. But she says something in this book practically screams at her, and it's about double standards being applied. We see people running the country who can behave however they want. And this book, she argues, is essentially telling us to behave properly and suck it up. You can have a look at that and see what you think. We also have Marta Herrero at Sheffield covering The Supermodel in the Brillo Box, which is backstories from the world of contemporary art. The supermodel in question and the Brillo Box in question can be seen on the cover. The Brillo Box is not wearing a top, neither is the supermodel. Our book of the week is an amazing book. Dick Hobbs, professor of sociology at the University of Essex and a very eminent scholar in the field of criminology, has read this book by Alice Goffman called On the Run. And she's only recently got her doctorate. She's a young scholar and it's an incredible book. He says, a truly wonderful book. The detail is incredible. The research is impeccable. Read it and weep. The book is about her 6 years living in an exclusively black neighborhood in Philadelphia and observing the growing criminalization and the huge expansion of the criminal justice system in the US and the impact it has on young black men. She also mentions the sorts of things that were said to her as a white young woman living in this neighborhood by the police with absolute impunity, kind of unrepeatably horrible things when she was accused of no crimes. And I asked her why she didn't consider going to the police with a complaint for the foot on her neck or for being asked how many of these black men she was prostituting herself to. And she said, nobody thinks that it's worth speaking to the police force there about anything they've done. They're a law unto themselves. It's a truly amazing book about what it's like to come from a white background and to immerse yourself in a part of the United States where apartheid is essentially functioning. If her name sounds familiar, it's because her father, who passed away when she was a few years old, was Irving Goffman. So an impeccable pedigree and a very exciting debut book.
Indeed, all that from page 50 this week. Thanks, Karen. And finally, the issue of universities' role in the training of public sector workforces on the agenda at the Universities UK members' meeting this week. It's also the topic of our cover feature. And Holly, various professions covered in this feature, but you looked into the trends in nursing education. What did you find?
Yeah, I did. And I found that perhaps one of the big issues is that the cost to universities of training nurses is not actually met by the amount that they're given by this body called Health Education England, which funds a nursing training in the UK. In England. And at the moment, Universities UK and the Council of Deans for Health are looking at this price that they're given, universities are given to train a nurse. And as it was sort of set initially in 2002, and it's sort of renegotiated every 5 years, and this year is being renegotiated. And they say at the moment, universities are facing between sort of 8 and 12% shortfall. Mm. And Health Education England are trying to cut this even further by another 4%. So that's obviously an issue for universities involved in nursing. Now, the content that the universities can teach as part of the degree is pretty tightly controlled by the Nursing and Midwifery Council. But there's been some criticism lately since the inquiry into the scandal at the Mid Staffordshire NHS Foundation Trust of the fact that in about 2010-11 the Nursing and Midwifery Council deemed it more appropriate for nurses to get a degree rather than a diploma, as they had been doing previously in England. And the report, the Francis report into what happened at Mid Staffordshire, sort of calls into question this idea of nurses actually having a degree. And the media seems to have picked up on that quite heavily, saying that degree-educated nurses are perhaps too posh to wash, and that's why these appalling failings in care happened at Staffordshire. But the nursing academics that we spoke to about this said that it's a bit of an overreaction, really, and nurses have always sort of been involved in practical training, whether they had a diploma or a degree. So lots going on at the moment, really. Mm. And the Nursing and Midwifery Council sort of reviewing their standards, which sort of incorporate what the students are taught and trained in after the Francis report. So it'll be interesting to see how things change there.
Yeah, indeed. That features from page 36 this week. I did a couple of sections as well, policing and social work. Some interesting developments in both those areas, but I think I'll let you read the feature to find out what they are as we're running over a little bit. That's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast. There's more multimedia online if you're interested. A few podcasts from the Going Global conference that I was at in Miami, along with a 25-minute interview with Sir Patrick Stewart in the press for the X-Men at the moment, of course. But he speaks on higher education with us in a video that you'll find online in our video section. Until then, you can discuss any of the stories we've covered today, or indeed any of the stories in the magazine, by going to timeshighereducation.co.uk. You'll find us on Twitter, on Facebook, on LinkedIn, on Google+, all the usual places. Please do get in touch. But that's all for this week's Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.